Hey, good morning, good evening, good afternoon, folks, wherever the heck in the world you are. It's V, the Gorilla Economist, coming to you live on this edition of Rogue News. And we have with us a very special guest. Jeff Brown is with us. Jeff's work I'm actually a fan of. I actually ran into his work a couple of months back on radio, on China Rising Radio Land, China Rising Radio Sinoland. And I was like, wow, this guy gets it. He's a Westerner, he's been in China. And folks, Jeff is the author of 44 Days. He's also wrote the book Dr. Wright Reed's Treasure Trove to Great English. He's also the author of China Rising: Capitalist Roads and Socialist Destinations, The Truth Behind Asia's Enigmatic Colossus, and The Big Red Book on China. He's been a speaker at TEDx. He's been a contributor at Bookworm, Capital M Library. He's been in various festivals. He's been also featured in an 18-part series of interviews on Radio Beijing AM 774 with former BBC journalist Bruce Connolly. He has a guest lecture at the Beijing Academy of Social Sciences, as well as various international schools and universities. He's been a guest on radio and television programs like Press TV, The Daily Coin, Truth Jihad, Wall Street for Main Street, KFCF FM 88.1, Crush the Street, as well as having articles published on Covert Action Magazine, Titanic Lifeboat Economy, Op-Ed News, UNZ or the UNZ Review, Paul Craig Roberts, and many others. And now he's here on Rogue. He is a former Oklahoman, and he grew up on a family farm in Oklahoma, graduated from Oklahoma State University. He's a Sooner, and he went to Brazil while in graduate school at Purdue University. And here he is. He is with us. This guy has quite the resume. And Jeff, there's so much more Jeff has done. I'd rather have Jeff introduce himself. This is the first time he's here. Folks, you're going to learn a lot. You're going to get your paradigms broken in half, and your minds are going to be absolutely enlightened and enthralled. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you so much, V and CJ, for having me on. It's a real honor. I think, first off, I just want people to know that I'm not some guru. And you know, like some Indian guru, nor have I just, you know, flippantly, you know, come up with all of these ideas. It has been my arc of awareness has been long, hard, painful, and sometimes really, really difficult. I grew up, of course, in the 19, I was born in the 50s. I grew up, you know, with Sputnik and all the anti-communist hysteria and the USSR and Kennedy's assassination, you know, when I was in the third grade. But we were so imbued with a sense of purpose and a sense of righteousness, you know, the temple on the hill. And I don't think Americans really fathom just how much we are inculcated with this
propaganda.
With this propaganda, and I mean, it starts in the womb.
Yeah.
And church, school, yep. Television, advertising, Hollywood. It is so pervasive, and so. That's where I started out, feeling very smug and superior about my origins.
Right. Well, Jeff, we still are the temple on the hill, except we're the Aztec temple on the hill. And there's quite a lot of chests with missing hearts inside of them, and the blood is flowing through the
system,
man.
So, you know, I really, you know, proud American, and I still am. I've just learned the dark underbelly of empire, and so it took. I mean, I even was in the Peace Corps, you know, to help people, and very idealistic and. You know, lived with, you know, poor people, you know, in Tunisia for 2 years. But I still had this sense of not racist. I mean, if I said
call it a bias.
Yeah. If I said the N word when I grew up, I would get, literally a bar of soap, stuck in my mouth. So
Right.
it wasn't racist. It's just this sense of cultural and technological and moral superiority. I had that all the way through Peace Corps, and then I traveled, and well, I worked all over Africa and the Middle East for the next 10 years, and learned foreign languages, and but I still had it. I mean, I felt very smug about my, quote, liberaloid, liberal, I care. I was a Peace Corps volunteer, but I still had this smugness. And I got married in 1988 to a French woman, and 34 years ago, or now I guess it will be 35, and so we decided it was time to leave, and so we moved to China, and we were there from 1990 to 1997. I was a general manager of two companies. We don't need to go into all that detail, but I learned the language fluently, reading, writing, speaking, managed, dozens of employees, Chinese employees, traveled all over the country. We had our two children there. And I, but looking, I'll get there. And so we then decided to go to France for 5 years and be entrepreneurs. And we opened up a used compact disc and DVD shop in Normandy, where I am right now. And seeing France, for the first time as an entrepreneur was very, very edifying. It still had a lot of the post-war, socialism. And as entrepreneurs, my wife and I were growling about, all the rules and regulations. Then we moved back to the United States. In fact, I was on the airplane the first United flight from Paris to New York after 9/11, the one that was on all the televisions, the first commercial flight to return back to into American airspace.
Oh, wow.
And so my wife and I went back to Oklahoma for the next 10 years. It was great for my mom and dad because they hadn't been grandparents. Because we had lived overseas all for so long. And so it was great for my family. It was horrible for my wife and me. And we really saw, I was shocked at how much the United States had fallen,
Yeah.
socially, infrastructurally. Things were just falling apart. Nothing had changed. It was just like the same, nothing had changed. And it was just like, it was just looking dirty and a lot of poverty. It was saw a lot of poverty. So I was like going, well, those socialist programs in France maybe aren't so bad after all. I mean, even though for entrepreneurs like us, it was tough because of all the rules and regulations. But I suddenly developed a healthy respect for the fact that France and Europe in general had it's being completely dismantled now with the Lisbon Treaty in 2009, but still has a strong socialist style, medical system, et cetera. So then, unfortunately, we went bankrupt. I don't want to go into the details, but it was a nasty, ugly, contentious bankruptcy, and we got caught in the 2008, what I call rape of the middle class,
Oh, yeah.
by the Lehman Brothers and Wall Street, and we were in real estate, and we lost everything. So
Wow.
we went back to China with our younger daughter. Our older daughter had just graduated from high school. She stayed there on her own and went to college and on her own. And so we went back with our younger daughter to China. And so our first time there was 1990 to 1997. Deng Xiaoping, the Wild East buckaroo days of
Yep.
just street level capitalism, fast steady,
I remember Fast Eddie.
make a buck, lying, cheating, stealing. It was extremely wild for those 7 years. Nobody trusted anybody. It was just total street level jungle capitalism. And so then we had the socialist thing in France, and then we had the neoliberal thing in the United States. And I think this, it really helps to have these comparisons, because otherwise we don't know where we are. We don't know, you know, what is relative. And when we went back to China in 2010, this was after the 2008 Olympics, my wife and I were just gobsmacked. We just, what in the hell is going on here? It had changed so much. And for the better, the people, just the mentality of the people, not just the infrastructure, which was mind-blowing, but just the people, how they had changed and evolved and became much more Confucian and much less, you know, fast buck, you know,
less fast Eddie and more Confucius.
Yeah, more Confucius and Confucian. So we were really, really, really blown away. At this point, I got out of the business world, and we were actually teachers in an international school. We had been alternatively certified in Oklahoma before we left. Hmm. So we were teaching wealthy Chinese, mostly wealthy Chinese kids in international schools in Beijing. And I was so gobsmacked. We were just like, this is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And so it was like, I was still very much in this communism is evil and we're superior and socialism, you know, well, French socialism is okay, but, you know, and so I was kind of, you know, wavering there, and the communism is evil and we're morally superior and, you know, we're just better than everybody.
Well, we have socialism here too, Jeff, except it's only for the government.
You know? and the 1% and the 1%.
Exactly. For them, privatized all the wealth and they socialized all the risk. It's a win-win right. situation.
Yeah, for the
one. It's what our founding fathers envisioned, Jeff.
Yeah. Yeah. Not exactly.
Not exactly. Not even close.
So I told my wife, I said, you know, we used to travel in the 1990s. We traveled all over China. It was really spectacular. And, we had now, you know, a daughter going to high school or middle school in Beijing. So the summer of 2012, I started a little blog on, you know, the Google blog spot. I started a little blog.
Yeah, I remember blog spot.
I remember when I got 100 people looking at one of my articles, and I was like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
And, but I said, you know what? I have got to get out and see what's going on in the rest of the country to see, because Beijing's the capital, and you know, I said maybe it's a Potemkin village, and the rest of the country is falling apart at the seams. And I really had to get out and see it. And so my wife indulged me, and I took off in the summer of 2012, and that ended up being 44 days backpacking in China. And I intentionally went to the six of the poorest provinces in China, and to see for myself, you know, what was going on.
Sure.
And I basically, you know, hiked, took local buses, local trains, didn't fly, and I was just boots on the ground. I was just, and of course I speak, read, and write fluent Chinese, so I was able to talk to hundreds of people, and it was like, wow, it's the same thing all over the place. This whole country has been completely transformed, and the people have been have just evolved mentally and socially, and it was just. It was like everything that I had been raised with Eisenhower and you know, Kennedy and, you know, and everything else. It was just like, what is just this cognitive dissonance about how we're supposed to be so much better than everybody else. And then I was looking at all of this incredible development and change and the radical change in the people. And it wasn't, it was when I was, it was, I was in a, actually I did a recent thing on this. I was, went to a cultural revolution restaurant in a little town in southwest Sichuan, as I was going down into Yunnan, and I was like going, a cultural revolution restaurant? What? I thought 80 million people were killed in the cultural revolution. Why are they celebrating the cultural revolution? And the just the cognitive dissonance is, and I kept saying, well, you know, and I compartmentalized it and kind of forgot about it. And then I started noticing Mao posters everywhere. And I of course, they were back in Beijing, but I think I just didn't look at them. But I was starting to like notice everywhere, Mao posters everywhere. He's supposed to be a monster. He's supposed to have, you know, claws, you know, and not fingernails. And he's supposed to have fangs, you know, and not teeth. And the blood's dripping off of him. And he has green moss between his fangs. And he woke up every day to kill a million new people. And so I had these conflicts in my mind.
Yeah.
And I got back, and actually I didn't even think I was going to write a book, but I had used a swap, whatever that's, swipe, whatever it is, you know, where you can handwrite on a tablet. I came back with like 30,000 words, and I thought, well, this is not a blog, this is a book. So that's how 44 Days got developed into a book. Well, during writing 44 Days, I went back and researched the genocide, because I was basically thinking about genocide and, you know, that Mao was, you know, an exterminator and all this other stuff. And I got to the point when I finished the book and it got published, it was a question now of moral equivalency. I said, well, Mao and the communists, they were evil. They killed all these people. But I did a lot of research on the West and colonialism and imperialism, and discovered that they were just as bad as...
No, Jeff, we're pure as the wind-driven snow. We've never done anything wrong. We've never broken treaties.
And I did mention the Native Americans. I mentioned Palestine. I mentioned Southeast Asia with the French and the Japanese starving.
Oh, yeah.
8% of the Southeast Asian population. But anyway, so at that point I was like, well, we're both bad. Yeah. But something just kept eating at me, and I realized I needed to do more research. And so I decided at that point, and this is where the second book, China Rising, came into play. I realized I needed to do really a lot more research about the West and a lot more research about China. So I spent the next 2 or 3 years, you know, working thousands of hours. And the more I looked at the West, the worse and worse and worse it got, you know. It was really interesting, because at about that same time, actually what happened was about 2010, I saw a little clip. Somebody sent me a little clip of the World Trade Center building number 7 collapsing in free fall with no planes hitting it.
Well, that's because the fire, I don't know if you know this, Jeff, but fire has the incredible ability of melting steel, especially... And pulverizing construction concrete into microns.
So, absolutely. So, and I'm a certified science teacher. So but we had, you know, to protect our, I was still sort of halfway, you know, blue pill, and so I instead of red pill, and so we compartmentalize this stuff, you know. People just, we have an amazing capacity to just compartmentalize things and not see them. And so I actually saw that, but it was when I started doing research about all the genocide, the Native Americans and Africans, African slavery and all that. I remember that video and I looked at it again. And so then I started getting deep into the Western deep state. And so the first 100 pages of China Rising is actually about Western malgovernance, Western evil, the false flags.
Yep.
Everything. I do regret at that point, especially coming from Oklahoma, that I did not think about the Oklahoma City bombing. And of course, now I know that was an inside job.
Yep.
But anyway, I came away with I looked in a mirror in a Western mirror, and it was not a pretty sight. And I came away extremely revolted about all those ideals I had growing up just were shattered. I mean, just shattered on the rocks of truth. And it was painful. I mean, I even cried. And I mean, I was like, really, I mean, it was really painful for me to go through all this because, you know, America, we're number one and
the city on the hill.
Yeah, the city on the hill and all that.
The city of freedom.
And then at the same time, I did a lot of research into the Mao era. And I traveled to Hunan, where he was born. Saw where he was raised and where he went to school and where he taught, and really did a lot of research on Mao. And I realized that, and as hard as it is for probably most of the listeners out there to accept, is that. I was doing a ton of reading, and what I came to realize is that everything, all this anti-China propaganda, is first off, I've now realized, is fundamentally at its heart goes all the way back to the 19th century Yellow Peril, Asian race, racism against Asians, but especially the Chinese.
And before that was the Red Peril against the Native Americans.
Yeah, the Red Peril, exactly.
Well, we've always been in peril since for quite some time. There's some sort of peril going on.
Yeah. I mean, China Rising, well, the trilogy, just, I mean, I don't want to get into it, but what we have all been brainwashed about the culture, the Great Leap Forward, and the Cultural Revolution, is a manufactured lie. Just like, Russia, COVID. I mean, it's just, we are very, very, very good at just implanting these memes in people's minds. And I realized that, of course, at that point, that Deng Xiaoping, when Mao died in 1976, Deng could not have gotten out of his chair without the incredible advancements that happened in China during the Mao era from 1949 to basically 19. He died in 76, but the Deng's policies came into effect in 1978. So the Mao period, kind of bled over for a couple of years. And I just, and I keep reading, and I read books. I started reading books. I thought, well, what a novel idea. Why don't I read books on China by the Chinese? It's just like, wow, what an original idea. And so let's hear their side of the story. And that's what I did. And I've read thousands of pages. I read books by people who were there during the Great Leap Forward. I read books by people who were there during the Cultural Revolution. A couple of them, Mo Bo Gao is a professor at the University of Adelaide in Australia. The other one, Dongping Han, is a professor at the Wilson College in North Carolina. These guys, you know, grew up in extremely poor, I mean, dirt poor villages in China during both the Great Leap Forward from 59 to 61 and the Cultural Revolution from 1966 to 1976. They were there, and they tell the truth that it's not all this scar literature, you know, all these writers who are paid millions of dollars to just write the worst lies about China, like Frank Dickotter, you know, Mao's Great Famine, and and Wang Chung, you know, who wrote Wild Swans, and her husband Johnny Halliday, and it's just, it's called scar literature, and you know, Mao's Physician, and I had read all those, and that's why when I was, you know, I had already read all those before I came back in 2010, and that's why when I was sitting in that restaurant in Southwest Sichuan in the middle of nowhere, you know, and they're like, you know, and praising, you know, the Cultural Revolution, I was like, what in the hell is going on here? But then I realized, you know, the Chinese are not stupid. You know, they know who has helped them, and they know who saved the country. And it was Mao Zedong, the People's Liberation Party, the People's Liberation Army, and the Communist Party of China. So it's just been crazy. And now I just, and I know I piss a lot of people off, and I probably hurt my readership and donations and everything else, but I just tell the truth, and I know the truth. I know what happened in China. I know what is happening in China. I talk to people there every day. And in fact, I'm going to try to go back next month, now that the COVID thing is at least temporarily blown. I'm going to try to fly back in February or March. Be my first trip back since we left in 2019. Anyway, it's just all I can tell you is, unless you want me to go into detail about the Mao era, it's not what you think it is. I think
let's start with this. The Cultural Revolution is a major sticking point, and we all know the narrative that we get out of the West. You know, 52 million people were killed, so on and so forth, during the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution. That's the number that's been thrown around often everywhere. 52 million. There's been zero real accounting done whatsoever in this regard. So why don't you break down for us what the heck really happened with the Cultural Revolution? What was the real truth behind that?
Well, let's start with the Great Leap Forward, because it is an amazing story from 49 until 59, when the Great Leap Forward started. China and the Soviet Union were cooperating a lot together. Yeah. The Soviet Union had thousands of engineers and technicians and scientists in China to help them. You know, we have to remember that when China got its independence in 1949, the Western imperialists were flooding the country with heroin, morphine, and earlier opium. Approximately 25, up to somewhere between 15 and 25% of the population was addicted. It's sort of like you, wherever you live, imagine every fourth house on your street being a drug house. And that's kind of like what it was in China. And the life expectancy in 1949 was 35 years. I mean, if you can believe
Jesus.
It.
Jesus.
And so literacy, 20%. China had a steel industry the size of Belgium's. The infrastructure was only to the extent that the imperialists, you know, basically France, Britain, and the United States could haul off all the booty, you know, back to, well, bring in all the drugs and haul out all the booty. It was when they called it the sick man of Asia, it truly was the sick man of Asia, from 1839, from the Opium War, first Opium War, until 1949, when the communists liberated the country, extremely, extremely in bad shape. And so within 2 years, and this is a fact, within 2 years after 1949, Mao and the communists got rid of all the drugs, gambling, prostitution, child trafficking, loan sharks, the mafia.
Yep.
Everything was wiped. All of the scum of Chiang Kai-shek. You know, the KMT and all of that, the typical, you know, the typical crimes, you know, on criminality, robberies, and all that was gone in 2 years. They did it in 2 years. And so at that point, they were able to build. The Great Leap Forward was ambitious. Let's put it that way. It was ambitious, maybe a little bit overly ambitious, but to put things in perspective, you know, China knew that it needed to industrialize, and if they were going to become a world power, and take care of the people and serve the people. And so, just I want people to realize just how successful the Great Leap Forward was. And if industrially, if you take the British Industrial Revolution, the German Industrial Revolution, the American Industrial Revolution, and the Japanese Industrial Revolution, the Meiji Restoration, and in the 1860s and 1870s, take those four Industrial Revolutions' three best years, and China's Great Leap Forward outperformed all four of those industrial revolutions by 10 to 30%. So in 3 years, China went, in fact, in those 3 years, they used 25% of all of the coal that was used in China from 1949 to 1976 in those 3 years. It just got 9 of the 10 largest hydroelectric dams still existing today were built in during the Great Leap Forward. What's the number one? Well, the 10th one, of course, is the Three Gorges Dam on the Yangtze River. They installed, you know, tens of thousands of kilometers of roads, tens of thousands of kilometers of telegraph lines. They installed a very efficient postal system. They restored and for irrigation control thousands and thousands and thousands of miles of, well, your kilometers, whichever you prefer, of riverbank. I saw these little dams. They made over 10,000 hydroelectric dams for small villages, which I saw on 44 days on these small rivers. You know, these little dams were producing enough electricity for people out in the middle of the boondocks to have electricity. I mean, I could go on and on and on. And so what does the West harp on, at least industrially? Oh, well, they needed more iron. They needed more pig iron to make steel. And so they tried to recuperate old iron and old pots and pans. Okay, it didn't work, but they quit doing it after about a year. But that's all you'll hear people talk about, the Great Leap Forward. Now, as far as the hunger is concerned, unfortunately, at the same time that this started, of course, they had collectivized all the land. The agricultural land had all been collectivized, which is a big boogie bear word, you know, in the West. It was actually going quite well, but unfortunately, for 2 years straight, 1959 and 1960, China had the northern half was in drought, and south of the Yangtze River was in floods. 200-year droughts and 200-year floods, 2 years straight. So everybody wants to blame the collectivization policy for the hunger. There was a small amount of starvation, but it was mainly just good old fashioned hunger.
It was basically natural disasters that have done the work between the floods and the droughts that have wiped out the crops, destroyed the harvest season, wiped out the crops, and therefore, and again, this is on the backdrop of just coming out of World War II.
Yeah, exactly.
That makes sense. So
let me just finish. They, at the same time in 1960, Mao Zedong knew that Khrushchev, who had taken over from Stalin, you know, who was again another one of these. He was actually an incredible leader.
Yeah.
But he anyway, Khrushchev was the Gorbachev of his era. He was the Gorbachev. He was the one that destroyed the Russian Revolution. He was the one that destroyed basically the country. He set it up. And in fact, I've talked to Russians who think he was maybe even a CIA asset. and Mao was an excellent judge of people. And he and Stalin had a testy relationship, but they respected each other tremendously and supported each other, but not great friends, but they respected each other. Mao hated Khrushchev. He called Khrushchev, you know, a saboteur, you know, a counter-revolutionary. He was destroying the Soviet Union. And he was right. You know, he was right. So because of that, the Soviets in 1960, it was just this fall, I think it's something like October 21st or something like that, the Soviets just hopped up, left the country, took all the blueprints, and left the Chinese holding the bag with all of these developmental at the same time as these droughts were going on. So it was just a terrible realignment. And I know that what I'm saying is true because Mobo Gao in Adelaide, Australia, and Dong Ping Han at Wilson College in North Carolina, you would think that if they, you know, if it would be so easy for them to just go along with everybody else and say, oh yeah, it was horrible, 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 because they're PhDs at these universities, but they wrote books and said, in fact, the collectivization saved lives because they were able to allocate and reallocate and move resources around, food resources around the country. There was a lot of hunger. Remember, almost all of the people who did die of hunger or starvation, almost all of them were 60, 65 years old. And this was when the life expectancy was still only 50 years of age.
Yeah.
And so it was a huge rip-roaring success. They became a steel producing powerhouse. They developed infrastructure, agriculture. It was a huge success. Now, people will tell me that you're just full of poop, Jeff. You know, that's just a lie. Well, I'm sorry. I've done my research, and not only Mobo Gao and Dong Ping Han, whom I both interviewed. If people want to read their interviews, and their books are outstanding. They said it's not true, and they were in really poor villages. You know, one in Qingdao and one in Jiangxi province. That gets us over. And what's really interesting is that since the Great Leap Forward, In the 2000 years before the Great Leap Forward, China had at least one major famine for 1,826 something like that, 1,800 and something years. Out of 2,000 years, China had at least one major famine for basically every year for the last 2,000 years. How many famines have they had since the Great Leap Forward? Zero. Zilch. Goose egg.
Wow.
So let's get to the Cultural Revolution. All during the, you know, Mao, like everybody else, there were a lot of counter-revolutionaries. Well, first off, there were millions of left-behind Japanese imperialist soldiers who were left behind. There were millions of fascist KMT, you know, Chiang Kai-shek KMT fascist soldiers left behind. So there were a lot of people left behind in the country who wanted to destroy the revolution. So they did a lot of, they did, you know, they had to either re-educate those guys or get rid of them. Believe it or not, compared to other revolutions, they estimate that only about 2% of all of these bad guys were actually killed, which is an extremely low number. And most of those were done locally by the local people to the landlords and the super rich who were basically, you know, exploiting them, raping them, beating them, ripping them off. Some of those, about 2% of those were killed. The rest were educated, re-educated. And of course, the Americans, and they hate the idea of re-education, but these people were re-educated. The problem for Mao was there was a lot of corruption. And this is the symbol for six in China. He had six campaigns from 1949 to 1966 trying to rid the country of corruption, basically in the party, the Communist Party. He tried everything. He couldn't do it. The people were upset. You know, everybody was extremely unhappy with the way things were going. Also, the rural people were extremely unhappy, which was at that time about 80% or 85% of the population was rural, that their kids were not getting the education they were promised because all the old, Confucian style, you know, teachers who were embedded in the educational, the Ministry of Education and all the schools, were very elitist. That's the one bad thing about Confucianism. It's a little bit, it's elitist. And they were very upset that their kids could not get a decent education. That's why it's called the Cultural Revolution. So Mao got so upset at failing six times to rid the country, basically the party, of corruption. There's a famous quote where he said, you know, I hear you can buy a bride. No, you can buy a county. You can buy a county party leader for a pack of cigarettes. You know, he was extremely disgusted. So the Cultural Revolution was number one for education for the masses. And the masses were all the peasants. That was 85% of the people at that time. So the other one was to get rid of corruption. So he said, well, if the party is not going to clean up its act, the people are going to clean up the act. And so basically the Cultural Revolution is nothing more than the world's greatest direct democracy in the history of humanity. He basically, that's when he said bomb the headquarters, he was saying kick the living ass out of the Communist Party of China and clean it up. And that's exactly what happened. the people at the local level, if you can imagine this, a billion people at the local level decided we're going to get rid of corruption. And they did. What, were there some innocent people hurt or killed? Not millions. But were there some innocent people hurt? Were there some grudges settled, some personal grudges settled, et cetera? Of course. You can't, you know, a billion people doing this, the greatest direct democracy experiment in the history of the world. Of course, there were some innocent people who got hurt. However, it's very interesting, that, and this gets into false flags, it's actually been proven that when they during the first couple of months of the Cultural Revolution, supposedly all these temples were destroyed, and Buddhist temples were destroyed, and ancient artifacts were destroyed, and all that. Well, you know what that, you know who those were. This is classic, you know, counter-revolutionary stuff. It was the people who were against the elites, the elites, who were the ones that were being attacked by the peasants and the workers. They were the ones that were getting who were getting the short end of the stick on this deal. They were the ones who dressed up all of their people in Red Guard uniforms and went out and destroyed, you know, all this stuff to discredit the real Red Guards who were out trying to, you know, clean house. And so anyway, it worked. The only reason that Mo Bo Gao and Dongping Han are full professors at Western universities today is because of the Cultural Revolution. Because before that, they would have never gone to school. They may have gotten up to sixth grade, U.S. sixth grade. But thanks to the Cultural Revolution, tens of thousands, and it was all done locally. It was the people who did this locally.
Right.
You want local government? Well, this was the greatest experiment in local government that ever happened. It was the local people who got their resources together, built schools, did the best they could. You know, maybe the teachers weren't Confucian, but they found the best and the brightest to educate their kids. Tens of millions of children who never got to go to school, maybe third grade, maybe sixth grade, were now going to middle school and high school and being given an opportunity to go to university. And that's exactly what happened to many, many people like Dongping Han and Mo Bo Gao. They got to go to university in China thanks to the Cultural Revolution. All right. Wow. So I want people to understand this. I mean, there is so much BS. The other thing is, well, there was no production. That is wrong. It is true. The first year of from 66 to 67, the GDP dropped like, I don't know, 15 or 20%. I mean, because it was total chaos, because all of a sudden a billion people were going, okay, we're going to clean house. So they, and you know, and all these Wang Chung and all these scar literature writers, you know, who, how we suffered during the Cultural Revolution. That's because they were the 1% who were corrupt.
Yeah, they were the proxies.
They were living, you know, up here, you know, while everybody else was, you know, they were the corrupt people in the party,
yeah,
the Communist Party, who got their short sheared.
Sure.
And so of course they all escaped, and now they're making millions of dollars, you know, being, you know, with chairs and supposed think tanks, anti, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what, if Americans ever take back their country, if we ever take back our country, Jeff, you could bet a lot of guys in Wall Street, in Washington, D.C., and places like that will be like, oh, how it was terrible, the second American Civil War. We suffered. Oh, my God. I'm sure they'll write the same books.
I tell you what, if anybody in the United States wants a good primer on how to do it, Read how the Chinese did it with the Cultural Revolution.
Interesting. That's something we need to look at.
At the end of the Cultural Revolution, there was no corruption. I mean, there was zero corruption. There was zero, I mean, it was zero crime. Nobody even locked their houses.
Right.
There was total honesty. And it was a, if you want to call it that, you know, the Gini index, you know, the index about, you know, how wealth is spread. One, a Gini index of one means one person owns all the wealth, and a Gini index of zero is the entire wealth of the country is spread perfectly evenly between every person.
Mm-hmm.
The Gini index at the time of the Cultural Revolution was 0.15. I mean, it was extremely egalitarian. This other idea. So the first year, the GDP dropped, I think it was like 15 or 20%. Even including that first year in the Cultural Revolution, the average GDP growth was 8% a year. So this BS that it was chaos the first year. During the Cultural Revolution, they built an atomic bomb. They built thermonuclear weapons. They built intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Yep.
They built satellites and launched satellites into space. It was actually, again, you have to just.
That's a leap.
You know, it's just unbelievable, but you'll never know this and people will deny it. Oh, it's not true. That's not true.
They were all driving around in ox carts, man. That's not true. How can these grimy Chinese communists come up with such great technological advancements? My God.
So the weak link, if you look at the entire Mao era from 1949 to 1978, the weak link, I mean, of course, by the end of the, when he died, I mean, China was already, its life expectancy when he died was 65.
There you go.
So 35 and 49 and 65 in 76, 77, 78. He almost doubled the life expectancy. Literacy rates went from 20% up to like 70%. And so you just infrastructure, everything. So the other thing that's just, you know, fascinating is that how they dealt with this afterwards, because unfortunately, Deng Xiaoping, his son, you know, his son was a bit of an, he got thrown out of a window and was paralyzed from the waist down after that for the rest of his life. He never gave up. He actually never gave up on China or the revolution. And I think he's still alive today and has been a proponent of the party and everything. But Deng had a bit of a grudge, you know, against what happened. And so how did they finesse this? And so the whole thing, when they came out, I will tell you that they Deng, and when they afterwards in 1980, 82, they did a thorough study of the Great Leap Forward, and they calculated based on census reports and everything, that approximately 25 million people died during the Great Leap Forward.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about out of a total population of, you know, 700 million.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it was mainly weather. It was weather driven. They decided that Mao was 70% correct and 30% incorrect, which is very funny because Mao used that same quote about in one of his speeches, 70-30. If someone can do 70-30, we should keep them.
Mm-hmm.
And But Deng could not have gotten out of his chair without the Mao era. I mean, he basically took a broken, miserable, addicted, flat on its back country
Jeez.
With no hope and no future. And in 25 years, another thing for all you ladies out there, Mao was the greatest women's liber in the world.
Mm-hmm.
He went before the revolution, before the independence, when they were up in Yan'an, holding out against the KMT and the Japanese. He kept telling his associates, the first law we're going to pass is a law, is what he called the marriage law, but it basically was a gave women equal rights. And because before that it was pretty bad, I mean, before Mao came along, I mean, women couldn't own property. I mean, they were basically chattel property. And he did that. And when the first law they passed in 1950 was called the marriage law, and it gave women full equal rights. When my wife and I would open up a bank account, we've got bank accounts still open in China. A man and a woman cannot open a joint account. They will not allow that to happen because they don't want the husband to control the woman's money.
Wow.
So my wife and I we have to have two individual accounts. That's why China has so many women doctors, engineers, professors, scientists, researchers in the military. I mean, you name it, you know, they're business owners.
So Jeff, he liberated
overnight 250 million women.
That's amazing. So Jeff, you're telling me that if CJ and I were to move to China, our wives will not be able to have the same checking account as us, and have to be separate. See, there goes our idea, bro. This is ruinous to us.
Yeah. Move on. Move on.
The weak link, the worst aspect of the Mao era, it was food. Even though he increased the GDP six times in 25 years, he increased the food production three times in 25 years. But the problem was is that when the Communist Party took over in 49, there was about 480 million people, which was extremely low. The population from 1839 to 1849 didn't even barely grew 100 million people, because everybody was sick and dying and addicted to drugs. But so after they took over, you know, food, you know, health, you know, the barefoot doctors, you know, millions of barefoot doctors, and that's why they were able to increase the life expectancy so much, and better food and sanitation, and they got rid of parasites and diseases but so they went from 500 basically 500 million in 49 to over a billion, you know, by about 1970.
That's incredible.
So the population was increasing so fast that even though they increased food production by three times, they really needed to increase it about five or six times to keep up with the rapid increase. So when in 1976, when he died, nobody was starving, but nobody was, you know, it was pretty lean. It was pretty lean. Meat was a bit of a splurge. Anyway, I know the Mao era really, really well. I think Mao Zedong in the whole was the greatest. I'm talking about for the people.
Yeah.
For his people.
Yeah.
He was the greatest leader in the 20th century.
Yeah.
As I always say, no man did so much
for his people
in so little time than Mao Zedong. And that's true.
That's incredible. I mean, that this is the complete opposite of what the West teaches us, man. I mean, the West for decades now, now that we have nothing but a hollowed out economy, we're a paper tiger, we're you know, masquerading as a civilization. It's ridiculous where we are. We are taught narratives. You know, I was just listening to Lieutenant Scott Ritter interviewing Victor Bout. Right, Victor Bout.
The Russian, who was framed for gun running.
Yeah, the God of War. That yeah. You know, then they made the Nicolas Cage movie Lord of War, and they loosely based it on Victor Bout's thing. Which Victor Bout was doing contracts for the DOD. He was just delivering supplies. Some of the supplies were weapons. Other was like you know, MREs and God knows what not. No drugs. No human trafficking. Nothing. They needed a narrative. The West needed the narrative. This is 2008 when the West was actively involved in regime change operations, which they've done in China with Tiananmen Square, which is repackaging of Operation Yellowbird, which they did in Burma, you know, back in the earlier 80s, right? So it's amazing that you have this innocent man's life ruined for 14 years over a lie. And every American's like, oh, yeah, he's the Lord of War. The guy had nothing to do with that. It's incredible. But people just believed it. And they had an idiot jury in the Southern District Court of New York, which is my old home state, right? Where they just, they're like, oh, yeah, well, you know, we saw the movie, Nicolas Cage, he played you. You know, this is, you know, it's most likely it. You're an evil man and you're going to go away for 14 years. Ridiculous. So this is what they do in the West. Character assassination and narrative is the greatest power that these Western oligarchs have. Why? Because their ultimate game is wealth extraction.
And that's why I call it the big lie propaganda machine. But unfortunately, it's so effective. I was just reading yesterday. I didn't even know about it, but apparently there were some letter bombs in Spain next door.
Really? Wow.
I'm in France. There were some letter bombs that went off in Spain. The police didn't know who did it, but then of course the big lie propaganda machine in Washington and London jumped on it and said, "Oh, it must be the Russians trying to destabilize Europe."
Yeah, I mean the Russians have the ability to do that. I don't know if you know this, Jeff. They can mail a few letters out and put baking soda in, it will destabilize an entire Western democracy, just like they can buy $10,000 of Facebook ads and steal an election in 2016. Yeah. It's incredible what the Russians can do.
Incredible. And so even the Spanish police and security said it's not the Russians. But I just saw this the day before yesterday. The New York Times, which is nothing more than a CIA chop shop, came out saying unidentified or high-level sources, they always use these anonymous sources, said that it is very likely the Russians who are doing this to destabilize. But this is what is so sad, V, is that will get picked up by CNN, MSNBC, BBC, the whole big lie propaganda machine will pick that up and will just run with it. And then in 4 weeks, you can interview people anywhere in the West and ask, is Russia involved in the letter bombs in Spain? Yeah. 75% say yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The same thing. It was just like the Uyghurs, you know, the Muslims. Oh, God,
the biggest lie ever.
The Xinjiang concentration camps. They had, you know, Soros, George Soros, and NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, you know, CIA. They create this, you know, East Turkestan Liberation, you know, organization with their own flag, you know, the typical color revolution. So what do? They get a guy from that organization who probably lives in a townhouse in Georgetown in Washington, D.C. They ship him up to New York, and at 8 o'clock at night, he goes into the General Assembly of the United Nations and gives a speech so that it's officially recorded so that it's officially recorded in the United Nations, you know, records, the journal of all the speeches given, that there are, well, at first off, it was hundreds of thousands, and then it was 1 million, and then it was 2 million. And of course, you know, it was like, you know, 10 or 20% of the population, but, you know, it ended up being supposedly imprisoned in gulags in Xinjiang. But they have they took that, gave it to New York Times, gave it to the Washington Post,
yep,
gave it to CNN, gave it to MSNBC, gave it to the BBC.
And they all ran
away.
And now you
ask anybody, well, of course there's gulags there. Of course Trump was involved. Of course Trump is responsible for what happened on January 6th in Washington, you know.
Yeah.
You know, of course it was the damn Democrats who did it to stop the Republicans from questioning the vote.
Correct.
So but now it's just, it has become so much a part of the, you can't question it. It's just, you can't question it. And that's why you can't question, you know, you can't question the Cultural Revolution. You can't question the paradigm that we have. You can't question that. Mao was a murderer. Stalin was a genocidal murderer.
Everybody was a murderer except us, because we're God's gift on this world. We're as pure as the wind-driven snow. We fight for freedom wherever there's trouble. I'm a real American, so on and so forth. It's absolutely ridiculous. And the whole thing on Xinjiang, I've said it so many times before. This is probably the most incompetent genocide program I've ever seen, Jeff. I mean, how do you create a genocide program where, you know, in Xinjiang, the people's life expectancy went from 42 years of age to now it's about 71. They had 400 mosques about 30 years, 40 years ago. Now they have 22,000 mosques.
Yeah,
the number one singer in the number one pop singer in China is a Uyghur woman. The Uyghur language is written on the Chinese note. The Uyghurs have a special access to university where halal meals are prepped for them and prayer rooms are provided for them. They've radically changed the Xinjiang through economic development, where you had CIA proxy groups and terrorist groups that used to pull off 300 terror attacks per year, has been whittled down to practically zero thanks to the policies over there. This is the most incompetent genocide program I've ever seen. They really need to consult with I mean, God rest his soul. What is his name? Zbigniew Brzezinski could have advised them how to do this properly. Come on, man.
Yeah.
It's unreal, Jeff. It's unreal. Which brings us to the next thing, Jeff. Okay.
Yes.
Now, I'm a money guy, you know, working in the former financial industry, spent many years. But so that's my talent, is to follow the money and figure this stuff out. A lot of Americans are confused. Okay, they'll say things that China is working with the American deep state in order to overthrow America. Well, if the Chinese are working with the American deep state to overthrow America, then why is the American deep state trying to encircle China in the South China Sea, sanction China every chance they get, create terror groups in Chinese provinces, set off false flags, and then use Taiwan as Ukraine 2.0?
Yeah,
you can't have it both ways, but you know, the average American doesn't figure this thing out.
Which
brings us to COVID, and people wanted to know about China's so terrible to their people. They've locked them down. They're using drones. They're drone striking the people, like the Obama years. You know, when Obama would kill, you know, 16-year-old American citizens in the Middle East, you know, and without due course or whatnot.
Due process,
exactly.
Yeah.
So would you like to comment on China's response and how they actually viewed COVID versus the West? Because I'll also tell you my side of the story, which, you know, you and I haven't talked about this before we went live, but I guarantee you, bet your bottom dollar, that you and I are going to put together some two pieces of a puzzle, and it's going to be magic. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, we need to understand that China is the most biologically weapon-attacked country in modern history. The Japanese from 1935 to 1945 had Unit 731 in Harbin, up near the Russian border. And it is estimated that they killed somewhere between around 300,000 people, and they perfected biological weapons from airplanes, from airplanes making bombs out of ceramic and sort of like, you know, corrugated iron bombs that would break open on contact and release mice and voles and insects. And they got as far down, they got as far south as Ningbo, which is north of Shanghai, doing this, and they got very good at it. The Chinese at that time learned how to fight against, you know, these biological weapon attacks, and they got really good at, you know, compartmentalizing and separating, you know, people who had contact with all these bugs and stuff. And so they got really good at that. And then in 1951 and 52, the United States, of course, the United States took Unit 731 back to Fort Detrick, took all the, you know, Shiro Ishii, the head guy, the head psychopath, 8,000 biological slides, microscope slides, and a couple of containers of information. That's what started Fort Detrick, the biological weapon, the biggest biological weapon operation in the world. And so they basically took Unit 731's blueprints and tried to do it on the Yalu River between North Korea and China. It was in the winter. A few hundred people died, but they definitely did biological weapons then against the Chinese and the North Koreans. So the Chinese are very used to this. Yes. The fact of the matter is that in Wuhan in 2019, there were the military world games in, I think it was October, the 2 weeks in October, and 312 American military showed up to compete. And I put compete in quotation marks because I'll tell you what happened. Usually, these are really serious. I mean, these games are really taken really seriously by the military. It's like the Olympics of the militaries around the world. Usually, of course, you can imagine it's a duke out between first, second, and third place between Russia, the United States, and China. You know, because those are the three biggest militaries. And well, for some strange reason, in 2019, the United States didn't even win a gold medal. They didn't win a gold medal. They were called, the Chinese were mocking them in Chinese media, calling them soy sauce soldiers. And the United States came in like 47th or 48th place, like between Bahrain and Guatemala, something like that. Oh, I've written all about that.
That's because we're elite. We don't want to, we don't want to show forth how elite we are, lest we intimidate the competition, Jeff.
So obviously the people that were sent over were not athletes. They were bioweapon specialists.
Bingo.
And they were at the Oriental. They were at the Oriental Mandarin Hotel in Wuhan. All 312. The very first symptoms, and it's unfortunate that China, you know, hushes this all up because they don't want a hot war with the United States. So they deny, because if the people, if the Chinese government came out and said, "We know the United States did this," they would lose face to their people unless there was an appropriate response. And the only appropriate response would be a hot war, and the Chinese don't want a hot war. So they also cover this up to keep on the development track, infrastructure development, economy. And but the very first symptoms were among the local staff at the Mandarin Oriental Hotel in Wuhan, where the Americans were.
You mean to tell me it didn't happen at a wet market between a pangolin and a turtle?
Well, the wet market is about 300 meters down the road from the Oriental Mandarin, and but that again, that was just the Americans, you know, did that, and you know, the Chinese are trying to cover it up, and they don't want to get into it, but clearly they were attacked in Wuhan. I think, to be quite honest with you, there was a double benefit for the World Economic Forum crowd, because they knew what the Chinese would do when they realized that they had been attacked. They knew they would do just like they did against the Japanese in 1935 and 1945. They knew what the Chinese would do just like they did against the United States during the Korean War. They went into war footing. They went into total mobilization to stop this from spreading. That's why when they had 50 million people quarantined in the Wuhan area, China had to assume that it was a bioweapon. They have to assume that it's a bioweapon, and that has been the way they treated this until recently. And I'm still trying to go through, you know, why they decided to just suddenly lift it. Now I'm a little bit curious as to why, unless they have the vaccines now, you know, that they can produce, or maybe they just got tired. The people were getting tired of it. I'm in contact with a lot of Chinese, and
yeah,
they were getting tired of the lockdowns. Although, but you know what? Up until they changed the rules recently, poll after poll in China showed 82% of the people polled supported the zero COVID measures. And I have friends in China who are still afraid to go outside because they're afraid of a Western bioweapon.
Correct. And that's the thing that people have to understand in the West. This is what I said before years ago as well. They're taking it that this is a bioweapon. I mean, you look, folks, there's over 300 labs. A lot of them are up and down Asia that are ringing China. And so, you know, these are U.S. bioweapons labs. So they take it as a biological threat. Now, watch this trick, right? Here is, and I'm going to bring this up. This is the other missing piece of the puzzle, and I'm tying it in on the financial side of things. Okay? This is very key, very clutch, very important. All right? Here we go. Airfinity. I talked about these guys briefly before. I'm going to dive deep in here and try to put it together because I didn't have all the pieces back then.
I saw a deal about them. They're the COVID propagandists.
Bingo. These guys are basically the ones who were hyping up. They were using the original Niall Ferguson concept. Niall Ferguson, the guy who told everybody to lock down. It's going to have like a 90% fatality rate. Of course, I'm exaggerating here, but Niall Ferguson is the one that convinced the British government to lock everything down. Meanwhile, while he was having a extramarital tryst on the side with a mistress, that was okay for him to do, but everybody else had to be locked down and scuttled. And the fear porn is big business, right? And fear porn serves a purpose. They knew if they can get Airfinity's data over into China and to initiate a severe, severe lockdown, right? That all of a sudden, you know, it's going to work in the West's favor, because the hope was it's going to hobble China's economy. It's going to break their economy. It's going to slow them down. But the narrative in the West is like, oh, the China released the virus to slow our economy down, to make us stumble and fall, and to remove Donald Trump from president because they're working with the American deep state. That's the narrative they told us.
No.
But the narrative on the Chinese side, Airfinity sent in a lot of people and said, hey, look, China's a data-driven country, you know, good for good and for bad, okay? In the sense that if you give them false data, they're going to act on the data, because it's democracy on the bottom, data in the middle, you know, and then talent at the top. I forgot the gentleman who said that. I think it was probably a colleague of yours. But so this is the situation here. So Airfinity goes there. They give them the data work, again, based on fake multipliers, based on fraudulent information concocted and cooked by Niall Ferguson, as well as Western intelligence agencies that spruce the numbers And then Airfinity, which has tie-ins with MI6, has tie-ins with Soros, a wanted man in China, Soros, as well as various NGOs, okay? They're the ones who told the entire world to lock down. They have their tentacles in the World Health Organization, and because of that, China, what did China do? Just like you said, Jeff, they responded as if it was a bioweapon. That's why their death rate was extremely low, right? Yeah. And then what they also did to scare the Chinese, you see, in the West, they started recommending, Airfinity started recommending PCR tests. PCR tests, which were originally created by the creator of the test, said this is useless for for diagnosing COVID. It's useless, and COVID only has a 99.97 survivability rate, so you don't need to lock down. So when the PCR tests, which are throwing in 90% false positive, and this is why every day in the West we started hearing 1 million new cases today, 2 million new cases of COVID, 10 million new cases of COVID today, right? And I know you got to go in 15 minutes. So basically, so the West got all this hyped up cases of COVID, then they fraudulently increased the death rate in the West. While 1 million people died of COVID, you could have died of a shark attack and then said you died of COVID. Then they took those numbers, and Airfinity went back to China and said, hey, look at what the West, they're not shutting down and locking down like you guys are. That's why they have millions dead and only 4,000 Chinese dead. See, keep locking down. It was a tactic to hobble their economy. That's what the whole thing is. And meanwhile, then the West unlocked, right? So much death here, but we unlocked, right? That was the whole entire thing. And then what happened? $10 trillion worth of wealth in the Western markets transferred from the have-nots to the haves.
Absolutely.
Go ahead, Jeff. I know we're limited on time. Go for it.
Well, but I just want to say that they knew by releasing it in Wuhan, they knew that would be they could all go, well, look at the Chinese. They're locking down. They're wearing masks. You know, we should do the same. You know, and so it was really diabolical. And the problem is, of course, you know, the Chinese government, if they went the Swedish way, you know, and basically didn't do anything, there would be a huge loss of face for the government. There would be a huge loss of confidence in the government. It could be a bioweapon, so we have to be safe anyway. And so China had to go on to a war footing. I'm a little bit mystified as to why they stopped suddenly. Maybe they just realize that the people are just, they just can't handle it anymore. Maybe I know, you know, another interesting thing, they never forced anybody in China to get a vaccine. I still have Chinese friends who are not vaccinated. Nobody was ever forced to get a vaccine in China. And of course they don't have the mRNA genetic treatment.
No, they don't.
They have just good old fashioned attenuated.
That's the loving Western governments to dispense upon their own populations because they love us so much, Jeff.
And then but they never got forced anybody. I think they just decided people were just getting just burnt out. And I think maybe they've realized a lot of the people have gotten, you know, 3 and 4 of the attenuated virus vaccines. And I think they just figure they probably have enough of a herd immunity that they can stop it. I think also, since the vaccines are government controlled, if they see a new mutation coming on, you know, in China, they can probably switch, you know, the vaccine production to the new genome. And I do want to point out that there's a really wonderful on Exposé News. It's a UK. They have a timeline of COVID, of the history of COVID going back into the 1980s with Anthony Fauci. But to make a long story short, Anthony Fauci and then Ralph Baric at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and Peter Daszak at Echo Health Alliance, they were the ones that gave money to the Wuhan virus lab to teach the Wuhan lab how to weaponize COVID. What Fauci and the guys got out of it was some bat DNA that got shipped back to the United States. I think that and Fauci, Ralph Barrett got $68 million to weaponize COVID in North Carolina. China, the Wuhan lab, got a total of, I think, something like 5 million. So who did the real work to weaponize COVID? And I think actually, although it's been terrible for China from a PR standpoint, with the Kung Flu and everything else, and the Wuhan, the CCP virus, but I think it probably saved a lot of lives, because Wuhan had the genome of the COVID of SARS-CoV-2 before anybody else did, and so they were already developing vaccines for it. That's why they were able to come out with a vaccine like within months of the public outbreak, because they already had the genome from 2015. That's when Fauci and Ralph Barrick and Peter Daszak at Echo Health Alliance gave Wuhan the COVID, the SARS-CoV-2 virus to learn how to weaponize it. So, but unfortunately, it's been a terrible PR, and it's unfortunate. Again, China has to go with the WHO, propaganda. It was from bats, and because again, if they came out and said we know that this was done by the United States, the people would be demanding justice and revenge, and the only thing that that China could do would be to
that point we'd be at a war.
A war or destroy its economic development by kicking all the foreign companies out. And but they don't want to do that. They're focused on development, infrastructure, economic development, improving the people's lives. So they play along with this lie. And but it was actually the COVID-19 is as American as apple pie.
Yep. 100%. Jeff, thank you so much. We covered a lot of ground. I know you're pressed for time. I'd love to have you back on.
Yeah, sure. It's been fun. You're a great host.
You're welcome, man. It's definitely been a lot of fun.
And CJ's a good engineer.
He is.
Well, thank you for that, Jeff. I appreciate it.
I can barely walk and hold my drool. So there's no way I can multitask this, but without CJ makes it so much easier.
Definitely. Thank you so much for having me on, and I will get this transcribed.
Yes.
So it'll be in print, and I will promote it on my website. I'll promote your website, and we'll have win-win mutual benefit together.
That's what we love. Yep. Definitely, Jeff. Absolutely. Right. Folks, get Jeff's book. Follow him on Twitter. We have all the links in the description box. With that being said, CJ, take it away.